This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Welcome back to the Financial Sense News Hour. This is part of the program which we call The Big Picture. Jim Poplava, John Loeffler here with you. What we would like to do is to cover the interrelationships of themes that we have been putting forth on the program over the last couple of weeks. Back at the beginning, well, I guess it goes further than that, because back at the beginning of the year, we talked about the fact that President Trump was the first president since George H.W. Bush Sr., to enter office with an aging business cycle and a Fed rate raising rate cycle. Every other president has begun in a recession with the Fed cutting rates. That was Presidents Bush Jr. and President Obama. And we'll have more to say on that as we go further about the historic significance of that. Another theme is the expanding bubble in passive index funds, which are driving the extreme valuations that we see in the FANG stocks. Put all these in your mind on a little checkoff here in a bulletin board. Number three, last week we were talking about the concentration of risk. You have to realize it's breathtaking almost when you realize that five banks control 90% of the nation's deposits, four banks control 93% of derivatives, five financial institutions control the majority of our nation's stocks and bonds and mutual funds, and four institutions control the bulk of the passive index funds and the exchange traded funds, meaning that all of this is concentrated in a relatively small area. So today, having enumerated those three, we're going to put forth another one that interconnects with all of the others, the melt up before the meltdown. And you better tell people what you mean by that, Jim.
Well, usually when you come to the end of a business cycle, things are always doing very well. I mean, the economy's doing well, the stock market's hitting records, but usually you end up with a bang. Think of, for example, the stock market in 1999 and then going into the first 3 months of the year 2000. The NASDAQ was up almost 70%. Melting up in 1999, and then it began the year and it was up another 20%. It went from 4,000 to over 5,000. So when you come to an end of a cycle, you normally go through a melt up. And one of the contentions here in the program is market tops are more a process, not an event. You don't wake up one day and there's an event that happens and that's it. The market peaks that day. It's usually a process leading up to a top. So the topping process takes place over time, and it takes place in a background where everything is going well. Now, if you look at where we are today, it's our belief we're in the late stage of a business cycle with this recovery now in its ninth year. Now, I want to make the point that things are usually very, very good at the end of this cycle. The economy is growing. Unemployment is low. The stock market is at record highs. Bear markets and recessions come afterwards, not when things are going very well. I mean, if you think back to 1999, the beginning of 2000, nobody was thinking of a recession. Nobody was thinking of a bear market that would send stocks down over 50% over the next 2 years. Fast forward to the years 2006 and 2007, the economy was overheating, real estate was booming, the stock market would go back to a level it hadn't seen in the fall of 2007 to a level that it reached back in the spring of the year 2000. Everything was going great. And then, of course, we know what happens. So, John, when you're normally towards the top, you're more likely to see euphoria. People are giddy with excitement because their mutual funds, their stocks are going up double digits. Unemployment is low. Everybody's working. Consumer confidence is high. Retail sales are up. The economy is booming. All of that stuff happens towards the end, but we know what eventually brings that end about, which is always and always has been since the end of World War II, a Fed rate raising cycle, which we are now in.
Okay, let's begin this conversation with the economy. We know that the stock market is at record highs, but GDP growth has also picked up.
And that's what you normally see towards the end of the cycle. Good times are here and they seem like they're going to last forever. And we're seeing this with the PMIs are looking very strong right now, especially the ISM manufacturing and non-manufacturing indexes. For example, the ISM manufacturing index was in September at its highest level, trending up from the beginning of the year. It reached 60.8. And the same thing we saw with the ISM service index that hit almost 60, 59.8. That's also trending up. And that tells me, despite the weather that we had with those hurricanes towards the end of August and September, we could see a GDP print eventually at 3% for Q3. So the economic numbers have been picking up. Other LEI indexes, for example, the ECRI, Leading Economic Indicator Index, the Conference Board's Leading Index, all of these economic indicators are on an upswing. Now, the economy is improving. It's not as robust, but it's not the anemic growth rate of 2% that we've seen over the previous 8 years. And as many technicians here on the program point out, things are going well internationally as well. So in summary, John, the economy is growing and the economic growth rates are picking up here as well as internationally.
You know, the technicians that we have from week to week here on the program have pointed out that things are going well internationally as well, which I think you mentioned too. So I would classify that, I would think, as another positive.
Well, it is. Global growth is in sync for the first time since after the recovery. In fact, this week, the IMF just raised its forecast for this year to 3.6% and 3.7% for next year. Now, that is, just to put this in perspective, that's a major improvement from the last, let's say, 8 years. And even last year, where global growth was only 3.2. So now they're talking 3.6, 3.7, almost close to 4%. So what we're seeing here is a broad-based acceleration in economic growth here and abroad. And unlike the past decade, what we're seeing also, John, and we saw that this week, is forecasters are raising their estimates towards the end of the year, where if you look at the last 8 years, normally when you got to around this time of the year, October, September, October, the rosy forecasts for economic growth that were made by either the Fed or Wall Street was being revised down. Instead of 3% economic growth, which they forecasted forever and ever, they were talking about, we're going to have to wind that down to maybe 2.2 for the year, or 2.3. So the realization by the time you got to the fourth quarter of the year is things weren't going as well as forecasted. Now you're seeing just the opposite. Everything from the Wall Street economist to the IMF, including the IMF this week, raising their economic forecast. So that's different. So outside some kind of black swan event, 2018 could end up being the strongest year for growth since 2011.
Yeah, this is the typical end of a business cycle. We've cited it quite a bit here. Things are looking good. I mean, the economy, both here in the U.S. and globally, it seems to be firing on all cylinders. Everything's going. But in the background, and that's where you begin to see the changes first, you know, certain things happen first and there are lagging events as well. Central banks everywhere seem to be raising interest rates, which raises the little flag. And then the question comes, all right, if that is a predecessor to the beginnings of a downturn, how much further can it go before it does?
Well, I think we still have a ways to go because, once again, we talk about when it ends, it's more of a process. And we haven't quite got to the euphoric stage, but we're seeing all of these elements fall into place, and we're going to lay them out for you. We talked about, for example, economic growth is picking up. It's picking up here, where we are likely to see 3% economic growth for Q3, as well as the 3% economic growth we saw in Q2. The IMF this week saying that economic growth, they're raising their estimates for this year and raising them even higher for next year. And then we're also seeing this reflected in stock markets around the globe. Japan's Nikkei just closed at a two-decade high with an improving economy and improving profits. And, there's been a lot lot of attention here in the financial press. What do you hear when we talk about stocks on this program? New records set for the Dow, the S&P, and the NASDAQ. But there's also new records being set overseas. The EAFE index is up 22% this year, and the MSCI Emerging Market Index is up nearly 33%. So everybody is popping champagne bottles over here. But actually, the best stock appreciation for 2017 has actually been overseas rather than in the U.S. So global stock markets are starting to heat up, especially overseas. So what are we seeing? Economic growth is picking up here and abroad. Markets are rising to new records here and internationally. So all of this is a sign of what you normally see towards the end of a business cycle. Things begin to fire on all cylinders.
You know, I've always heard you say that when trouble erupts, it will erupt in the bond market. So if this is our earthquake swarm before an eruption, what's going on in the bond market?
Well, we're seeing the same thing, just like you're starting to see euphoria in market evaluations. In the stock market, you're seeing it also in the bond market. Junk bond spreads are narrowing considerably, and not just here, John, but globally as well. And you're starting to see money pour into the speculative grade sectors of the market, not just in junk bonds here, but also in emerging debt as well. A good example to just show you, I talked about the amount of money that is going into passive indexing. We're seeing it also in the speculative end of the bond market, a record $221 billion so far this year in speculative grade bonds. That is up 60% from last year. I mean, you're seeing countries you would never think of enter the bond market. This week, Tajikistan did its first ever bond sale with an interest rate at 7 1/8. In fact, if you look at the average yield on speculative emerging market debt, hit 5.5% this year. John, 2 years ago, it was at 9%. So it's not just that you're seeing individual investors come back into the market, but you're also seeing it in the bond market as well, because there's a global search for yield. And so there's a lot of debt that's coming to the market now that is aggressively priced. One country, for example, a month ago, came to the market and the bankers were saying, hey, you're going to have to pay 9%. The country said, no, we're going to pull out, or it was actually a mining company. And they said, we don't want to pay that kind of money. They waited a month and the interest rate they were able to sell came down from 9% to 8.3%, because investors right now are starved for yields. So money is pouring, just as it's pouring into passive index funds, it's also pouring into speculative debt with $242 billion. You know, you compare that to where we were last year at $102 billion, more than double. So this is another sign you want to see in the topping process, which is a disregard for risk in all forms, whether in stocks or in bonds. So, you know, we talk about passive index funds in that bubble. You're seeing the same thing happen in speculative junk bonds, speculative emerging market debt. And what that's doing is suppressing the yield on speculative high risk assets. So investors really are not getting compensated for risk. You know, as I mentioned, 9% on emerging market speculative debt 2 years ago. Today it's at 5.5%.
Jim, we know the Fed is raising interest rates and is now shrinking its balance sheet. But, you know, we're not at the danger point yet, because historically we're still at record lows. And this week on the premium channel here, you were talking about this with Jim Paulson from the Luthold Group, to which he said,
you know, historically or traditionally, you know, there's the old three steps and stumble rule, which us old people like me remember from back in the 70s and 80s, where once the Fed tightens for three times, it's the end of the recovery and it's also a bear market. I think, though, that it's very different this time, and it is because of what the Fed has done in the post-2008 crisis. They've taken monetary policy so far out of bounds from anything it used to be that I think we're going to have to renormalize it before it really becomes that relevant again. So the Fed has already lifted rates, you know, four times going back to late 15 in this cycle, and yet the funds rate is still, as it sits today, about 0.5% or more below the rate of current rate of consumer price inflation. And I think it hasn't that much impact. They've been raising rates, but the whole time they've been doing that, you've also had the stock market continue to go up. You've had the economy actually accelerate. And I think it's because negative interest rate after inflation really doesn't do much to shut us down. You know, the Fed is probably going to, I think before it becomes a meaningful force, they're probably going to have to get the interest rate above the rate of inflation so there's some real burden on the economy before it has a lot of impact, before anyone really notices. And that doesn't just mean up to the current rate of inflation, because inflation is also rising. So, you know, by the time the Fed gets around in December to lifting the funds rate again, the current 1.9% consumer price inflation rate might be well over 2%, almost making up the difference for another quarter point hike.
If you'd like to hear the whole of that interview, that was an interview Jim did with Jim Paulson, two Jims here, a strategist at the Luthold Group. It was Friday's show this week, the 11th, and that's on our premium channel.
You know, the thing, John, that you have to remember here, and we'll bring this up more with a couple clips here from my interview with Paulson, there is nothing that has been normal or ordinary in this business cycle, either on the economic front and especially on the monetary realm, or for that matter, in the investment markets. I mean, if you take a look at a typical business cycle, the Fed brings us into recession, the economy goes into recession, we're in a bear market. Now the recovery, usually following a recession, begins after the central bank eases monetary policy. When that happens, business and consumer confidence returns, money and credit begin to multiply, and then what you begin to see is rising demand puts idle resources, hence labor, capital, the unemployment rate comes down, that goes back to work. At this stage of the cycle, money supply begins to pick up. Now, at this point, you don't see inflation because you have this underutilization of resources, which diminishes at some point in the recovery. And this is something that Paulson and I talked about. At which point do you get the, let's say, the unemployment rate down to a level where you're starting to see wage acceleration, which is running now about 3%. Now, normally in a particular labor market, when it becomes increasingly tight, when the jobless rate falls below the non-accelerating inflation rate of employment, or what we call NARU. Now, with the supply of workers, as long as they're, if they're insufficient, then what happens is the existing pool of labor starts to gain bargaining power. And you're seeing this with more workers leaving jobs, moving on to other jobs. And what happens is labor cost begins to accelerate. It drives a fall in profit growth. And when real wages propel stronger demand, as we're seeing in confidence and spending, then all of a sudden, as inflation rises, the central bank tightens. Now, so far, we haven't really seen inflation in the economy. It's been running below the Fed's target rate, but that can change rather quickly. Where we've seen the real inflation, where the money that the Fed has created has gone, has been mainly in assets. In fact, there was a cover, I think, on The Economist or a magazine recently talking about the appreciation of almost everything. And that's typical of most cycles. But this cycle has been, if you look at it entirely, there's nothing about this cycle that has been, I would say, ordinary. So it's been different. So expect on the back end, the top to be different as well. As I discussed at the beginning of the year, what made Trump and his presidency different than those that preceded it, he entered his presidency at the end of a business cycle, and with the Fed actually raising interest rates versus, let's say, the presidency of Reagan, the presidency of Clinton, the presidency of George W. Bush and Obama, where we were in a recession and the Fed was cutting interest rates. What is also different is the theme that we've laid out here is physical stimulus is coming at the end of a business cycle instead of the beginning of a cycle. And also, fiscal stimulus is coming at a time the Fed is raising interest rates. Now, normally, what you want to see is monetary policy and fiscal policy acting together in conjunction to stimulate the economy. And you normally see that coming out of a recession, as we did in 2009. President Obama passed a budget that raised fiscal spending by almost $1 trillion. The Fed initiated QE1, a $1.2 trillion. So you had over $2 trillion of stimulus to kickstart the economy. This is different. What you have now is an aging business cycle. Economic growth is picking up. And now you're talking about a $1.5 trillion tax cut stimulus coming at the same time the Fed is working in the opposite direction. So you have monetary and fiscal policy now at odds, something I discussed with my interview with Jim Paulson.
But now, 9 years into a recovery, one of the longest recoveries we've ever had, and at a time when the U.S. is already back to full employment now with 4.2% unemployment, and there's already a show of wages going from around 2-ish up to 2.9 in terms of inflation. Commodity prices have been lifting again in the last 12 to 18 months, particularly industrial commodity prices. The dollar's been weak, which adds to inflationary force here. The bullet freight rate index across the globe has been rising again. In other words, to bring a fiscal stimulant at a time when you're at full employment in an aged recovery, I think is not necessarily all good. Because if enacted, I think it certainly would boost nominal growth, no doubt about it. But the problem right now is it probably boosts nominal growth more than real growth, because there just isn't the number of resources left unemployed to reemploy against that stimulus. It's an oddity to have the Federal Reserve in this country tightening monetary policy because they're concerned about overheat conditions emerging, while at the same time in Washington, our Congress is considering a massive fiscal stimulus to the economy.
And once again, that was a cut with Jim Paulson from the Luthold Group on the Premium Channel this week on Friday. Now, you know, we've been going through some of the stats here on the proposed income tax. I don't know if we should call it reform or not. I think that's a misnomer. But what do you think the chances are of a real worthwhile cut getting through? Because as you and I both observe, there are things that are really suspect about all of this.
Well, I mean, the Republicans are in a bind. They didn't repeal Obamacare. There were three things that Trump came in on his agenda: repeal Obamacare, tax reform and tax cuts, and infrastructure spending. So far, John, none of that has been done. Most of anything that's been done has been done with executive orders. In next year is a congressional election year. So the Republicans need to get something on the table. In fact, it was announced on Thursday. Paul Ryan said that we will work through the entire Christmas season in order to get a tax bill passed by the end of this year. So they know there's under pressure. But here's the thing. From my perspective, I'm in agreement with Paulson. This is coming at the wrong time. If they do pass a tax cut, as we've been pointing out, this could extend the business cycle a while longer, but it could also spike inflation and encourage the Fed to get more aggressive with rate hikes, which will bring this recovery to an end and bring about the next bear market. And so the one thing that I do not like at this time is monetary policy working against fiscal policy. You know, a lot of people will tell you that you usually want the two of them to work together, as they usually do coming out of a recession. If you take a look at the recession that George W. Bush inherited in 2001, what did you have? You had tax cuts, you had fiscal spending, and you had the Fed cutting interest rates. Fast forward to 2009, we're in a severe economic downturn, 2 years into a cycle, not to mention almost a 60% drop in stocks. Obama comes in, passes fiscal spending of almost $1 trillion, and the Fed initiates QE1 with $1.2 trillion. So they're both working together. Now, if the tax bill is passed, I predict the Fed will get more aggressive and raise rates even more. So you've got monetary policy counteracting or fighting fiscal policy, and that ends up in a train wreck because we know what the Fed will do. So that's point number one. Point number two, I think the tax cuts, as we've talked about, we did a show on this a couple of weeks ago, I think they're a Trojan horse because in exchange for lower tax rates, and quite honestly, not much of a lower tax rate, especially at the upper end, and also a lot of the Obamacare taxes, the Medicare tax, the Pease Amendment tax, phasing out deductions are there, and then you have the Medicare tax. But in exchange for that lower rate, you give up the deductibility of your state local taxes. Think about this for somebody that lives in New York City where you pay city tax, state of New York tax, and property taxes. That goes out the window. What also goes out the window is medical expenses. Think of somebody that has a serious illness and pays a lot for these Obamacare premiums for Obamacare. You know, if it exceeds 10% of your adjusted gross income, you get to deduct it. Well, that goes away. Also, think of all these hurricane victims that have had their homes destroyed. The property and casualty losses are no longer deductible. So, you know, in high tax states, like, for example, in California, like I am, we would actually experience a tax increase under this bill, especially at the upper income brackets. So what happens is they get rid of all the tax deductions, and then the next Democrat that comes into power raises the tax rates, but now you no longer have the tax deductions. So I don't like them. I think, number one, it's the wrong time. It's coming at the end of a business cycle, and it's coming at the middle of a Fed rate raising cycle. Two, it's really setting the stage for higher taxes down the road. And the best example I can give you is the tax reform bill they keep making reference to that, gosh, we haven't done anything like this since 1986. Well, what happened? In 1986, they got rid of tax shelters. They got rid of the excess deductions that you could get from investing in real estate. They got rid of the sales tax deduction. All those things went away up front. They took 4 years to phase in the lower tax rate of going from 50 to 28. We had it for 1 year. The following year, George H. Bush enters office, read my lips, no new taxes. He raises the tax rates to 31%, and he was followed after his one term only by Bill Clinton, who raised the tax rates to 39.6 and gave us the Pease Amendment. So I don't like it, John. I think it's coming at the wrong time. I think it'll force the Fed to get more aggressive, so you'll have monetary policy countering, but what it might give us is the melt up in the spike in the euphoria that the good times are here. In the background, the Fed will be working as inflation heats up to raise rates even more aggressively.
You know, it occurred to me you've been talking about the reflation trade maybe towards year end and hike in oil prices. Is that still on the table?
You know, I still adhere to that view. I believe it's coming next. There are several things that could bring it about. And the two big ones in my mind are oil and tax cuts. Both could cause inflation to rise. And I'm not talking about hyperinflation or anything like that. But let's say inflation rates start going to 3 or 3.5% above 2. The rise would be countered by a more aggressive Fed, and which, as we all know, the Fed will end up doing what it always does. And this is something that, I talked about with Paulson, this idea about what could spark inflation and then cause the Fed to get more aggressive.
Every recovery in post-war history has ended after some semblance of overheat conditions, after some period where upward pressure on costs became more noticeable, both commodity price cost as well as labor cost. And that resulted in rising yields and rising interest rates and tightening by policy officials, ultimately bringing the next recession. And I think this one's going to end the same way. I don't think we're going to have runaway inflation like the 1970s, but I think we're already headed towards more overheat conditions. And the scenario that you can paint is, let's say next Friday's payroll report or next month, the wage number that's published Friday morning is over 3%. Say it's 3.1%. That's going to capture a lot of attention among the bond market. For example, investors, first time wages broke above 3 in a long, long time. And if that occurs at the same time that, let's say, the dollar, which has been weak this year, down almost 10% from its high at the end of last year till recently, let's say it breaks to another new low again, which would give a boost to commodity prices and particularly to oil. So let's say at the same time wages go over 3%, the dollar breaks and crude oil, West Texas crude, jumps above $60 a barrel again. And at the same time, we look like we're going to be close to adding a stimulative tax cut on top of concerns already in the bond market. The embedded 10-year inflation expectation in 10-year TIP bonds is currently about 1.9%. And let's say while all this was going on, that jumped above 2% or 2.2% for the first time in a while. And suddenly you painted this picture where crude oil was rising, wage inflation was rising, the dollar was weak, adding to inflationary force. We've got a fiscal stimulus coming on top of that, and inflation expectations were also rising. And suddenly you could create a panic among bond vigilantes, wondering why they're holding such low-yielding treasury bonds. And with all the people that are overweighted in those areas because they've been too scared to go into stocks, you could see people starting to unload that. I think it's that scenario or something thereabouts, which tends to frighten me a little bit. I think we're going to deal with some of this, whether or not we have a tax cut, just from what we already have in place with worldwide growth now growing while the U.S. is the first one to get back to full employment. I think with a tax cut, it's perhaps accelerated.
Jim Paulson again on the Premium Channel this week on Friday. So, Jim, how does all this play out?
Well, once again, going back to our theme, melt up before meltdown, as you get to the end of a business cycle, as you get to an end of a bull market, it's a topping process. And it's all done when you have to get to that euphoric phase. And quite honestly, John, up until this year, we haven't had much of any of that. In fact, most of this stock market in its entirety has been driven by corporate buybacks and central bank buying. The little guy has been on the sidelines, mainly in cash or the bond market, and it's only until after Trump's victory, going back to November last year, that we've seen a large swath of money come into not only passive index funds, the individual investors coming back, investor sentiment is rising. We're also seeing it take place in the speculative market on the bond side with emerging market debt, junk bond debt with the narrowing of spreads, records amounts of literally hundreds of billions of dollars going into this area, almost double what it was last year. So what we have all the ingredients for a melt-up. Economic growth is accelerating, both here in the U.S. and overseas. Junk bond spreads are narrowing, and especially more speculation coming into the, what I call the high-risk bond market. Three, investor sentiment is turning more bullish. And four, investors, the individual investor, is coming back in the market. But before all of this comes to an end, you really have to get to that euphoric state, the melt-up, which will come first. And that could very easily come if the Republicans were to get a tax bill done by the end of the year. And I'm just taking by what Speaker of the House Paul Ryan said on Thursday. He goes, doggone it, we'll work through the entire Christmas recess if we have to get this thing done. So if that happens, that could give you that euphoria because we know, number one, it's going to raise corporate earnings. Obviously, if you go from a 35% tax rate to a 20, your corporate earnings are going to go up. So that could give that impetus for the stock market to head higher, sort of melt up. We might see higher economic growth, but behind that, watch the inflation numbers and watch what the Fed does. So those are the kind of things I think that are in place right now and how this plays up.
Given that that's where we are, what actions are you taking for yourself, your clients?
Well, I mean, it's no secret. We've been talking about this on the program. We're de-risking, in the words of Ray Dalio, we're dancing closer to the exit door. But more importantly, we're formulating our exit strategy because, for example, in 2000, we went into sovereign bonds. Hard to believe this today, given the shape of the euro and what's transpired, but we were in sovereign bonds like French, German, Swiss government, Canadian, Australian bonds, and then we moved into gold in 2001. Now, in 2008, about the only thing that worked during that downturn was cash in treasuries. If you were in bonds, corporate bonds, junk bonds, you lost money. If you were international stocks, U.S. stocks, I don't care, small cap, mid cap, large cap, anything that you had in the market went down. The S&P lost 58%. So just as this economic recovery has been not normal in any sense of the word, both on the monetary side, fiscal side, and even the way the markets have played, it is going to be different as well this time, which is where we're devoting our time to protect our clients. Because, I mean, a good example, this week alone, not only did the IMF raise economic estimates, but they also identified 9 big banks that are likely to have problems with profitability, from Citigroup to Deutsche Bank to Barclays and Mitsubishi. So they're already saying there are some banks out there that could have some problems, and we haven't even got to the difficult stage. So there has been nothing that has been normal about this economic recovery. And John, I don't think there's going to be anything that's normal on how this all ends. In the meantime, however, as I say, enjoy the melt up and ride, because this too will come to an end.
Wait a minute. You can't leave us hanging like that. You know, I mean, that's not going to work. What do we all do here in the meanwhile?
I mean, it's no different for any, the way any economic cycle ends. Don't get greedy, especially when we get to the euphoric stage. It's kind of like watching that gambler, John, in Vegas, that you see his chips piling up. And you think, dude, walk away from the table. You're winning. You have money. You can walk away from, but no, what does he do? He places them, all the chips, on one last bet. Don't get greedy. Number two, understand the risk that you hold in your investments or investment funds. We had a plan that we did recently, and the client had no idea they were in low-rated, speculative, what I call junk bond funds. They just thought, gosh, this is a great yield. They had no idea the risk that they were taking. Have yourself an exit plan. Know what you're going to do. Have a plan and begin to de-risk as we melt up, because like I said, they never ring the bell at the top. It's a process. It's a sequence that you go through before it all ends. But those are things that you should be doing. Unfortunately, most people will get caught up in the euphoric phase. You'll be turning on the news each night. They'll be talking about records set in the markets. They'll be talking about economic growth at a peak. They'll be talking about housing prices going up. They'll be talking about consumer sentiment. Everything is euphoric. Just remember, think back of what it was like at the beginning of the year 2000, or think back what it was like at the end of the year 2007. So don't get caught up in the hype. Don't get greedy. Don't be like that gambler that amasses a pile of chips on the table and he leaves it there and places another bet. Besides doing these things, my own personal feeling, John, is just like this thing has been so unusual, this business recovery. We've often talked here many times about how we'll see economic growth pick up in the second and third quarter, and then it slows down in the fourth quarter, in the first quarter, and we've had many first quarters where economic growth has actually been negative. We've seen uneven events like the year 2011, where we had almost a 20% correction. The PMIs roll over, and the Fed had to extend QE1, QE2, QE3. And think of itself. In 2013, the Fed announced taper. It has taken them 4 years to raise interest rates 5 times. So this has all been unusual. And as we talked about on the program last week, the concentration of risk, when the end comes, I think it's going to be fast and furious. This market will be down so many points, and it's going to catch people by surprise. And what will happen to most people? Let's say you're owning an asset and it's at $100, it drops to 90. You can see this on the charts, how this always plays out. It drops down to 90. You don't sell at 90 because you're waiting for it to go back up to 100. Well, guess what? It doesn't go back up to 100. Instead of staying at 90 and going back up, it actually drops to 80. Then all of a sudden it drops to 70. And then all of a sudden at 70, you're thinking, I can't sell now. I'm down 30%. And then it drops down to 60 or 65. And then you panic and you sell at the end. And don't think that can happen. Remember, in the last downturn, the S&P alone was down 58%. In the previous downturn in the year 2000, it was down over 50%. It's human psychology. It hasn't changed in thousands of years. Don't catch yourself caught by surprise or unaware. Because just like this has been unusual, I think when the end, when it arrives, will be unusual as well.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
You know, Financial Sense News Hour listeners should remember that our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense News Hour featuring interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
You actually discuss something that has huge implications, and this event may be the first that we've seen in recorded human history. So tell us a little bit about the shift that we could be seeing in the years ahead.
If you look at current world population, we're at about 7.4 billion, which is pretty high. But what's interesting is we'll likely never see it double again. If you look at the fertility rate right now in the world, it's at 2.4. By 2050, it's projected to be 2.1, which is actually the replacement rate. So on a world basis, we are just going to replace the previous generation. Another interesting consequence we've seen of this big change, though, with lower fertility and higher life expectancy, is that the world is getting much, much older. And this has its whole new share of issues to deal with.
Welcome back to the Financial Sense News Hour. Jim Poplava, John Loeffler here with you. By the way, this month marks the 100th anniversary since the establishment of the Soviet Union and the socialism that it introduced, which led to its collapse back in the late 1980s, right? 1989, right there. Socialism has been tried over 30 times in the history of the world, and it always results in a big disaster when it finally implodes because it promises something for nothing. Anyway, speaking of something for nothing, has nothing to do with the topic we're moving into. You know, technology is changing rapidly and reshaping the economy and the world that we live in. We had the Industrial Revolution back in the 1800s. We had then the computer and tech revolutions in the latter part of the 20th century, the 1900s. And then, of course, the internet popped up at the same time. And now we have what's being called the digital revolution. You have to zoom back to see the breathtaking changes as to how fast they have occurred. 100 years ago, one out of three people worked on the farm. Today, less than 2% of our population works in agriculture and produces more food than people were producing 100 years ago with more people working on it. Same thing for manufacturer. Less workers are producing more goods, especially as we move into the area of robotics, which requires fewer workers but higher skill levels. So guess what? We're not done. I didn't think you would think we're done. Hold on to your seats here because there's more change coming in ways that you probably not think of, and it's coming more rapidly than you could imagine. The world you're going to live in 10 years from now is going to be completely different to what we see now. So in this topic, we're going to talk about the disruptors. Most of us go through life on this continuum, and suddenly there's a non-continuum, and that's usually some kind of a tragic event or a positive event, but something that changes our routine. And the disruptors are those companies who are bringing about this change that we're seeing, this new revolution, and the dominance and the sway they hold over the economy. So that's the framing of it. Jim, take it away.
Well, you know, we've done a number of shows over the years. In fact, over the last two or three years, and one of the big things that we talked about was the disruption that was coming to the retail space. We've had experts here on the program. And one of the things that we talked about is the changes that are coming to our economy from e-commerce to robots taking over manufacturing and many of the white collar repetitive jobs being replaced by automation. And that's what I want to talk about today, the disruptors themselves, the companies who dominate the marketplace and are helping to reshape it. And there's a group that we call the Big Four. That's Amazon, Apple, Facebook, and Google. Then you have companies that are also disruptors on a smaller scale, Uber, Tesla, Airbnb, and even Netflix. every one of these companies are behemoths, similar to, John, it almost reminds me of the turn of the 20th century. At the beginning of the 20th century, you had these titans out there. There was Standard Oil in petroleum. Then we had J.P. Morgan in banking. We had Carnegie in steel. And we had Ford when it came to automobiles. And these were tremendous companies of their size and dominance. Their founders were tremendously wealthy. It was called the Gilded Age. Well, we're moving into that Gilded Age in a different frame, except for, rather than industrial type companies, they're technology companies. And you can see this reflected in the marketplace. We've talked about the market caps of these companies fueling what we call the passive index bubble. But when you look at the size of these companies, and many of these companies are going to end up being trillion-dollar companies. But today, the most valuable company on the planet is Apple, with this Friday a market value of $805 billion. Next to that is Google or Alphabet, with a market cap of $690 billion, followed by Facebook of $501 billion and Amazon of $480 billion. If Amazon stock keeps going like it is, it'll make Jeff Bezos the wealthiest man in the world. In fact, he was when Amazon hit its peak a little while ago. For about 15 minutes in one day, Jeff Bezos surpassed even Bill Gates, whose net worth was $91 billion. Now, each one of these companies are worth more than a handful of their competitors. And you really see this in the best example I can give you is Amazon, which is on this Friday, is worth $480 billion. It dwarfs, by comparison, anybody that even comes close to its market value in the retail space. Amazon is worth more than Walmart, that has more sales than the market value of an Amazon. It's worth more than Walmart, more than Costco, Kroger, Target, Tiffany's, Coach, Gap, Macy's, or Nordstrom's combined. And this is just one store. So each one of these companies are worth an incredible amount of money. And what makes these companies different is not only their market dominance and their capital size, but how few employees that these companies employ versus, let's say, the traditional companies of the past. And the best example I can give you is these companies alone represent $2.5 trillion of market value in just four companies. And combined, they employ 418,000 employees. For example, you take a company like Facebook, which is really one of the largest media companies in the world next to Google. Its market cap is $501 billion, but it only has 17,000 employees. Take another entertainment or media company like Disney. Disney has a market cap of $150 billion and has 185,000 employees. Or if you take, for example, Intel, a market cap of $184 billion and employees of 107,000 compared to Apple, that's almost more than four times the size at $805 billion and has only 116,000 employees. So the larger wealth that you see in these companies is concentrated in fewer and fewer hands, fewer workers, making their founders enormously wealthy in some of the wealthiest people on the planet. And it's not hard to fathom, John, somewhere down the road, we may be talking about our first trillionaire versus, let's say, the billionaires. In fact, many people are saying today with technology and many of the tech startups, as we've seen in the last decade, has turned individuals into billionaires. It's probably easier to become a tech billionaire than it is a millionaire. And these people are some of the richest people on the planet.
You know, what really strikes me here, if we look at the individual companies, is the tremendous value of their shares, but also the enormous impact which they're having on the whole economy.
It's amazing when you consider the market value of these companies. Let's start with Amazon. One of the advantages of e-commerce is you don't have to spend as much capital in storefronts, investing in stores, and of course the cost of running a store, especially in malls, and what that cost in terms of your overall cost factors. Amazon, if they do anything, has put its money in warehouses and robots more so than people and, let's say, brick and mortar, which is what contrasts Amazon from all of its competitors. And if you take a look at the stock valuation of these companies, and especially when you look at Amazon compared to its competitors, I mentioned that it dwarfs by comparison anybody that comes close to it. And it's not just the market value, but it's also what has happened to the stock price over the last 10 years. If you take Amazon, and this is by the end of 2016, because, you know, 2017 is yet to end. But if you take from the last 10 years, 2006 to 2016, Amazon stock was up 1,900%. Sears, which is basically going out of business, Sears stock was down 95%. JCPenney stock down 83%. Kmart stock down 59%. Best Buy down 49%, Macy's 46, Nordstrom's 21, Target down 15. You just take a look at that. In 10 years' time, Amazon up 1,900, and just about every one of its major competitors have lost stock market value. And John, you and I can remember growing up when, gosh, every single mall had a Sears, and then Kmart was once considered the big growth stock. And of course, that was supplanted by Walmart. But these big box stores came in. You know, it started out with the neighborhood store, but then you had the department store. Then you had the big box store, your Kmart, Sears, and also your Walmart, your Costco. And then now you have your digital store, which is Amazon. And what they do is just amazing. They are dominating the retail space. In fact, if you look at the Forbes list of billionaires in the world and some of the wealthiest people in the world, they've actually come from retailing. And if you look at an economy the size of the United States, the amazing fact about it, 70% of GDP in the United States comes from consumption. And what does that mean? That's you and I buying stuff, consuming things. And they're taking it and making it effortless. I don't know about you, John, but almost 55% of the American public is on Amazon Prime. And they make shopping effortless. You just turn on your computer or your smartphone, press a button, one click, and voila, it's at your house in 2 days, or some cases it could be at your home in a couple hours. Well, they're taking that experience even a step higher with Alexa. Soon, we will get rid of one-click shopping, and it'll simply be voice control. And I want to talk about what that means in terms of the economic moats that have been established by well-named brands throughout, let's say, the 20th century, and especially since the 80s and 90s. Amazon is using its massive data mining. Have you ever noticed when you buy something on Amazon, next time you click on, what do you have? You have pictures of items that are similar to what you just bought or what you were browsing at. So they are leveraging this big data, and they have unrivaled consumer purchasing patterns. One of the scariest things about Alexa is you have it in your home, it could be listening in, almost like Big Brother. But soon, your orders are going to arrive, and the way you shop with Amazon is going to change. With Alexa, no longer a click. You just start talking, Alexa recognizes your voice, and you can say, Alexa, I need to order this. Now, here is what is happening and what the implications are in terms of disruption. You have a lot of stores out there or manufacturers that have established a brand image, you know, from luxury items like Coach to even things in consumer non-durables, such as everything from diapers to shaving cream to razor blades. Well, one of the things that's happening with Alexa is when you say, I need something. Let's say you need Q-tips. Alexa, I need Q-tips. What you don't know is Amazon has set up something called Amazon Basics. Amazon Basics are not well-branded items. They are basically Amazon's store-bought version. It's kind of like going into a store and buying the store brand, which is cheaper. And what this is doing is eroding the once almost insurmountable moats that were protecting a lot of these well-branded companies. Everybody from Heinz to Procter & Gamble products to Campbell's Soup to General Mills to Kellogg's. In fact, there was a recent survey of affluent customers, and there was basically talking about, can you identify your favorite brand? In fashion, 80% of the individuals polled in 2007. Fast forward to 2015, that 80% in fashion that could identify brands dropped to 60%. In jewelry, it dropped from 58% to 40%. In luxury hotels, from 67% to 37%, almost a drop in half. In retailers, 47% to 28%. And it's amazing. I'm seeing this more and more. I do the grocery shopping in our family. And on my shopping list, my wife said, I need some Johnson & Johnson Q-tips. I went to the grocery store. I couldn't find it in the store. What I had was a choice selection of in-house store brands only, which obviously would have been much cheaper. So this is one of the things the big marketing companies are going to have to fight with the behemoth Amazon, is doing away of those brand moats, the image. In other words, are people going to pay a premium for a product that they don't perceive as value anymore? There's no longer brand loyalty. A good example you could also see is in razor blades, where Gillette finally woke up and you had Shave Club and Harry's taking over. I mean, men are paying $5 or $6 a month to get a month's worth of shaving supplies versus 4 or 5 months worth of razor blades. So now you're seeing Procter & Gamble having to respond to that to protect their brand imaging. So Amazon is disrupting not only the retail space, which you've seen with e-commerce, they are now disrupting brand loyalty, which they're doing with Alexa. And it's amazing because the company is not very profitable. If you look at its 20-year history, it's made a little over $5 billion, and most of that has come in the last couple of years. And what they've been able to do very successful is to supplant making profits with its shareholders and investors with a vision for growth. Because if you look at profits, Amazon has made very little given the size of the company and its market cap. But what it sells is a story. It sells lower cost. It sells greater selection. And it's working on faster delivery.
Well, we've already seen the effects of e-commerce on the closings of large numbers of stores. We don't have any Radio Shacks in our area anymore. And it was always great to run in there, you know, when you're working in the studio and you need to get parts. Now you have to order them online. But also, now they're moving into food areas. And that's a whole different venue.
There's a number of areas that they're disrupting, but, you know, it's not just the physical stores that are disappearing, the local neighborhood franchise. It's not them that's dying. It's the middle class and the smaller firms that serve them. Also, Amazon is moving into several other areas besides food, and I'll get to that in a minute. They're moving into apparel. They're moving into food, and they're moving into transportation. The biggest cost that Amazon has in its structure is its fulfillment cost. You click, you order something online, and Amazon gets to you. And the thing that I've seen here is you have deliveries. I get deliveries from Amazon 7 days a week. And it's not just a FedEx truck or a UPS truck. It's an Uber driver. So they're employing, almost like, John, where you used to have paper routes, they get people that live in a certain area, and they deliver packages from Amazon in their neighborhood, almost like a paper route. And the problem is, this model is unsustainable in the long run. So if you look at the 450 stores that Amazon just bought with Whole Foods, look for those to become distribution centers because they have to cut this fulfillment cost. So Amazon warehouses, Whole Foods stores will soon become delivery centers as they try to cut down the cost. And Amazon is moving in three fronts. They're moving and they're going to disrupt the grocery food business. You're going to have, and they're doing that with not only Amazon Brands, Amazon Fresh, but also Amazon Go. They're opening up, I think there's 20 Go stores now where actually you just walk in, you have your grocery cart, you have your app on your smartphone, and you just pick the stuff that you want, you put it in your grocery cart and just wheel it out to your car. Gone are the checkers. And they will have robots that will be stocking the stores, very few employees. It'll be automated. The other thing that Amazon is doing, it's building its own fleet of transportation. Heads up, FedEx, DHL, and UPS. They're not only buying their own fleet of airplanes, their own fleet of trucks, and their own fleet of cars. As I mentioned, in my neighborhood, we get Amazon deliveries for what I call the equivalent of Uber drivers, like a paper route. And soon to be driverless cars and also drones, because if you take a look at transportation costs are up 83% in just the last decade alone. So what is Amazon doing? They're building their own fleet to transport those goods and deliver them to you in a faster time. We're not just talking in 2 days. It may be 2 hours in the future with its own fleet. Alexa is killing the moats around brands with Amazon Basics. And soon, grocery store chains will change tremendously. And you're already seeing this in some of the big store chains where you have, John, I don't know if you have them in the stores up in your area, but most of the big chains here have self-checkout. So if you're going into the grocery store on Saturdays, as I do, and if maybe you're not buying a whole bunch of stuff, you can just go and you can just go through self-checkout. What does that mean? It's eliminating checkers. Think of all, there's 3.5 million people that are checkout clerks. There's 2.8 million salespeople, and there's 1.2 million stocking clerks. All three of these category of jobs are now at risk. In fact, there's such a disruption coming to the assault on brand monopolies and moats that even stores or companies as big as Procter & Gamble may soon buy their own grocery stores just to get their brands displayed, because more and more stores are going to what we call in-house brands, just like Amazon is doing with Amazon Basics, because the brand loyalty is going by the wayside. And so take a look for a consolidation in the food and grocery business. It will change. It's going to be automated. Amazon is doing this with Amazon Fresh and Amazon Go. And the grocery business is going to bifurcate into scale stores with robots that will give you 90% of the great store experience, but at 60% of the price. And you're going to see this with self-checkouts. They're not only moving into grocery, but they're also moving into apparel. So soon, you will be able to just order clothes. And when you order those clothes, they will arrive with an empty box. You'll try something on, the stuff you like, you keep, and the stuff you don't like, you just send back in an empty box. And with Amazon's data mining, they will basically know your preferences, and there will be fewer empty boxes returning.
You know, as you're talking here, I'm thinking one of our local chain stores now has internet shopping, and they have parking places out in front for that. And so before you ever get to the store, you do all your shopping, you place the order online, you pull up, And right now it's a person comes out, your whole shopping order is done and paid for. They just hand it to you in your car and off you go. You know, so that's some of the new changes. So what we're seeing here is they're not only disrupting retail, and that's why the food chains are trying to compete with this trend that you're seeing out there. So they're not only disrupting retail, but the food and transportation business, and they're also disrupting once unassailable brand moats, just as we've seen these radical changes where we went from, you know, over the air television to cable, then to satellite, then to all various ways of delivering products, to the point that a lot of people are watching what we call the cable TV channels, which really aren't necessarily cable, some are satellite, rather than over-the-air television stations. That was a radical shift. And there are some pluses and minuses to that in terms of information distribution. But nevertheless, it's this dramatic of a change.
And you know, and it's not just that. It's also Amazon's dominance of the cloud. And here's one that will surprise you. When you think of search engines, the first thing that comes to mind, you think of Google, which is amazing because Google was once associated with Yahoo, and they basically, Yahoo didn't see the threat. But when it comes to searches, believe it or not, there are more searches done on Amazon. 55% of all searches are done on Amazon compared to 28% on Google. I thought that was an interesting fact when I was doing this research and looking at that and saying, you know, when I think of search, I always think of Google. For some reason, I don't think of Amazon. But when you think of when people want stuff and you're thinking of buying something, where do you go first? You go to Amazon.
Okay, one of the other disruptors is Apple. And as we're talking about this, I keep thinking about, is there ever going to be some kind of an antitrust move as the competitors get competed against rather brutally? But Apple's one of those big areas now.
Yeah, and it was, in fact, one of the reasons that, you know, when Steve Jobs came back to Apple, one of the saviors, because Apple was about 6 months away from bankruptcy, is at that time, the Justice Department, everybody was looking at Microsoft. They weren't well liked, as was its founder. And Microsoft invested $150 million in Apple at a time they much really needed a lot of capital because they were almost 6 months away from going under. But if you look at Apple, look what it did to the music industry, not only with the iPod in terms of storing music, but also how it changed the music industry itself with iTunes. And then also think of what it did to computing with laptops and desktops when they came out with the tablet. I mean, we have a smart home. Everything in this house is run off either an iPhone or an iPad. You take a look at what cell phones did when they came out in 2007, when they came out with the first iPhone. There are many other things that the iPhone or smartphone brought about. But one of the things, do you ever hear about Motorola or Nokia at one time? Nokia thought that phones were just phones. They didn't think about email or texting or many of the things, or cameras, or many of the things that we do today. And then smartphones ushered in the digital world. Think of how many people buy things off their phone, search for things off the phone, watch movies on their phone. Think of the number of things you have in your hand, a device that was more powerful than the IBM mainframe computers of the 70s. And think also of the disruption in technology that the iPhone or smartphone brought in. Think of what it did to digital photography or camcorders. I mean, everybody walks around with their smartphone. So if you need to take a picture, it's right there. You don't walk around, guys don't walk around with, you know, a strap over their neck with their digital camera. Maybe they do if they're taking an extensive trip and really want to get some great photos. But even that gap is being narrowed with technology. So here you had a company that started out in the late 70s as a technology company and a computer company, and it morphed itself into a consumer goods luxury item. And yes, I'm saying luxury. And if you don't think Apple products are luxury, just take a look at the cost of a smartphone. You want to buy the new iPhone 10, you're going to pay $1,000. You want to buy a new iPhone 8, you're going to pay over $700. And if you compare that to what a Droid phone, you can get as little as $99. In fact, they did some studies. If you take a look at affluent areas in the suburbs, the predominant phone most people own is an iPhone. Go into lesser affluent areas, they own Droids. So Apple has been able to morph itself into a chic luxury item. people that have Apple products, they're considered cool, which is amazing because Apple as a company not only dwarfs just about any other company on the planet when it comes to profitability. So, you know, the growth that this company has experienced has been absolutely phenomenal. And it's just something that you're seeing, John, and they're not done yet. I mean, take a look what they're doing to watches, which may even come in to dominate. Look what they've done to the luxury watch market. I used to have some luxury watches. What I like most is my new Apple Watch. And I like the new one that I've ordered, which will be used as a phone. So I won't even have to take my phone with me. I just take my earbuds in my watch and I can make phone calls. I don't care if I'm on my boat sailing or whatever I'm doing. It is much easier. So it is disrupting just about everything.
We can't exit a conversation like this without talking about both Google and Facebook. And not only are they issues about how dominant they are in terms of companies economically, but also how they have changed the global commons where information is interchanged.
Well, not only that, but they're really considered media companies. In fact, when it comes to digital advertising growth, and let's say if you take the last year, these two firms alone accounted for most of the increased spending in advertising. And it's not just that they are considered media companies, John. They are considered more trusted when it comes to news. When you Google something, you trust that Google has no self-interest in what you find in your searches. So if you're going for a news story, you'll probably go to Google more so than you will to the networks. Or, I mean, think of what happened to the monopolies of the single newspaper that used to dominate the town. I know when I used to do seminars back in the 80s and 90s, if I wanted to get people to a seminar, I had no choice but to take the San Diego Union and pay their prices for advertising in the Sunday paper. That was it. They had a monopoly. I paid whatever price they demanded. Take a look at one time. The three networks that have been replaced by not only cable television, satellite television, Netflix, HBO, and others that have assaulted their once dominant monopoly. And the same thing has come when it comes to news. And the best example is the Weinstein scandal, which was suppressed at NBC in Time. And they went elsewhere and people were going to other sources when it comes to news because it's more trusted. But they've changed the whole advertising space. Think of the big advertising companies out there. Think of television and the oodles of money that used to be spent on radio and television, not only just for brands and for regular products, but also on political campaigns. A good example is the last two presidential elections. In 2008, Obama came in out of nowhere, beat Hillary Clinton and Mitt Romney. Mitt Romney spent a lot of his money in traditional media like television and radio. And Obama was hip and he used social media. And take a look once again, if you go back to 2016, Trump spent a fraction of what Clinton spent and he did it with social media. So it is changing not only the media space itself, it is changing the news business in itself. In fact, one of the tech titans, Jeff Bezos, bought the Washington Post for $250 million and he's digitizing the Washington Post and changing that versus the New York Times, which has fallen further and further behind, not only with its own credibility problems, but has failed to keep up with the digital and technological advances that how people get their news. Where are you getting your news today? You're probably getting it from your cell phone. You probably have apps that give you and bring you that news. I know I have several apps on my phone that alert me from various financial sources and various media things that get me. So, I mean, John, when you think about it, what are you going to find at 5 o'clock? What are network anchors going to tell you at 5 o'clock you haven't already heard throughout most of the day? Not much of anything.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right about that because the newscasts are going on and you have access to that and you have access to a lot of the news. However, I think the shift in that is moving toward people who are able, or services that can tell you what all of this stuff means. In other words, we're awash in data points. And the other thing that's happening is, you know, you were talking about Google. Google and YouTube, their trustworthiness is beginning to erode. There's a lot of challenges being made as they're engaging now in censorship of what's going on their services. And so this is another shift we're going to see, because we're moving away from that Wild West heyday of the internet where everything rode, to the point where, well, okay, things are changing now. As to how it finally shakes out remains to be seen. And there are others too. You know, we have Uber and Airbnb and others out there as well. And so it remains to be seen where all of this is going to ultimately shake out.
Take a look at Uber, what it's done to taxis. I mean, when I travel, the first and last thing I do and spend money on is Uber. And so it's much easier. It's much more convenient. It's less expensive. And Uber is not just the drivers themselves. Wait till you get driverless Uber, because that's coming. So Uber and Amazon are going to disrupt the whole transportation industry. Think of what Airbnb is doing to the hotel industry and what Tesla has done to the way we drive. The dominance of what they hold now is the premier luxury car when it comes to electric cars, but also they're making their new models. So who knows? But the thing that's happening here is, once safe modes, I don't care if it's network television or to brands that were predominant, whether it's Coca-Cola, whether it's Kellogg's, whether it's Heinz, whether it's Campbell's Soup, are all being assaulted by companies such as Amazon Basics, or even the stores themselves are going to their own brands. Advertising being assaulted by social media, and technology is changing the world in ways we can't even imagine. We did a show on the number of jobs that are going to disappear. Now, we think of a lot of things that are disappearing in the retail space, the things that are disappearing in manufacturing with robots, but a lot of white-collar jobs are also going to disappear. I just mentioned in retail, when it comes to clerks, salespeople, and stockers, most of those jobs are going to go by the wayside. You go into Amazon warehouse, it's not populated with a lot of people. It's populated with robots, because Amazon bought a robot company. And what this is doing, as we've seen with the concentration of wealth in these companies not only have gigantic, enormous market capitalization, cheaper avenues of capital, but it's concentrated into fewer and fewer hands, fewer and fewer workers. In many ways, we're moving closer towards a 21st century version of feudalism, where you'll have lots of lords and nobles, but a lot more serfs. And unfortunately, a lot of the hyperbole that's based on why this wealth disparity, a lot of it is coming with technology, because technology, I don't care what they say about it, is displacing a lot more workers than the jobs they are creating. And it's something that we're going to be dealing, social scientists and politicians will need to deal with, because of the immense, enormous power that these companies command and their ability to control and disrupt economies. And it's only beginning, and it's also accelerating.
Yeah, and I know for me, I was always thrilled with all of this. I remember when the first archived radio shows showed up on the internet. Now, you still remember, you still had to stream them, but you could listen at any time of day when you wanted. And so if you missed a particular talk show the day before, you could go back and you go to their website, click on it, and it would come up in Real Player or some of the other formats. Originally, it was Real Player, and then Microsoft moved into it with Microsoft's players, and they ultimately passed them for the most part.
Yeah, just think of the history of the show. When you and I started this show back in 2001, you listened to it on a Real Player. You had to turn your computer on and have it come out of your speakers. And then all of a sudden we got the iPod, and then that gave birth to the podcast. Think of what that did to radio stations. I didn't think about that other disruption. I mean, you can syndicate globally and do it from your home.
Yeah, a lot of times I'll be driving around town too here and listening to something coming off the internet. Listening to a radio show is coming through the cell system, you know, internet to cell system, rather than coming off of broadcast radio. So, and yet I'm still driving around listening to it as I do it. So it's been a radical change. I think in a lot of ways it's been a big plus, because the people who were able to keep a tight chokehold on the information flow have lost that capability. There are negatives to that, however. So we'll see. Anyway, in the weeks to come, assuming that we're still streaming as we are and that technology has not routed us out, what are we looking forward to?
Well, we're going to be right in the middle of Q3 earnings season, and we'll also be watching for some big economic reports to come out. I think the third quarter economic growth rates are going to be much better than most people thought, despite the disruption of the hurricane. So we'll be talking about economic growth, corporate earnings, and of course, it's all just about baked in now, unless something dramatically happens, that the Fed will go again in December, raising the Fed funds rate to 1.5%, raising rates three times this year. It'll be interesting to watch what happens when the Fed funds rate exceeds the rate of the bonds. And that is something, in other words, can we eventually get an inverted yield curve? I don't think that's going to happen as much, because there's just too much buying between what's happening overseas, the rates that you can get on treasuries here compared to what you could get in Europe, something that Mark Chandler and I talked about in hour one. But that'll be the areas that we'll be focusing on in the weeks ahead.
But don't forget, by the way, you have a seminar coming up. We need to tell people about that as well.
Oh, that's right. Thanks for reminding me. We have our investment strategy meeting where we're going to be talking about some of the very things that we've been covering here on the program, from the concentration of risk to the end game to the disruptors to a couple things that are coming out that could affect financial wealth here from a planning perspective. So a lot of things coming up, and that'll be held next Saturday. It'll be an all-day event here in San Diego. Thanks for bringing that up. In the meantime, on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense News Hour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.